Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Stephen the Warman Writes Kickfighting Podcast Show. I'm your host, Stephen the Warman. You are listening to this podcast in one of two ways. Either you are at my blog, which is lordgaul.podbean.com. I try to upload an episode to it once a week, and I promise you guys I would do one once a week until the end of the year. So I try to do that on a regular basis. But the most efficient way to get my podcast is to go to the iTunes search engine and enter Warman Kickfighting Show or Lord Gaul, and the show pops right up. Lord Gaul was my username back when I fell in love with the sport. So when I was on Kakatugi, when I was on K1 Fans or K1 USA, that was the username that I used. So I am joined by Caitlin Young, Muay Thai fighter from the US, also promoter, also matchmaker for Invicta, super famous person. Caitlin, say what's up to the people.
Hello.
Caitlin, where can they find you on the social medias?
I am on Instagram at Caitlin Youngify. Gosh, I should know my Twitter handle. It's Caitlin _Young. And then Facebook, just by my name, easy to find.
Okay, cool. Well, we'll get right into it. First of all, Caitlin, we are, even though we know that you deal with MMA, we keep it stand up here. Keep it stand up here, Muay Thai kickboxing. My question for you is, could you take us down the journey of how you first got into Muay Thai?
Yes, absolutely. So I was kind of like in trouble when I was a teenager. My mother made me pick an activity, and I had gotten into Olympic style Taekwondo from like 14 on. And I was doing pretty well in that. I had qualified for national team trials at the U.S. Open and whatnot, and my coach had gotten deployed to, it was Iraq, I believe, or Afghanistan at the time. I forget, it was 2004. So I didn't have any, he was like the competition coach, it was a small gym, so I didn't have anyone to train me, so I went to a kickboxing gym. Like, it was like high kick kickboxing rules, it was the closest thing I could find. And trained with them and ended up taking a couple fights and going to trials. I wasn't successful there. And then I, stayed in Taekwondo. I was coaching at the University of Minnesota, their team, along with myself while I was competing a little bit. And, then I went to a referee's clinic and they were discussing the rule set and they said, it's really important that nobody kicks above the ankle. And, you're sitting there thinking, well, if it's the most efficient way to kick, what do we care if somebody comes in and does it wrong? We'll lose. So I asked that question. I said, why do we care if they kick with the shin? And they said, we want to keep the Thai boxers out. Which, of course, then makes you wonder, what is a Thai boxer? Mm-hmm. And why are we afraid of them? So shortly after that, I sought out Minnesota Cali Group is the first place I had found that had Thai boxing. And I was there a couple weeks. The focus wasn't so much on competition, which is really what I wanted to stay in. But I went and saw Nat McIntyre fight in Chicago, because he was a Minnesota guy. That was amazing. It was for the U.S. title. I forget which one. USKA or something like that.
There's too many. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. And I was just blown away by it. So then the next morning, I was at Minnesota Martial Arts Academy, and that was so like 12 and a half years ago or so.
That's crazy. Did I tell you that I too started at Minnesota Cali?
No, I don't think you did.
No, yeah. Oh, once upon a time, I got into the sport because I was a Taekwondo kid too. I had a friend who was really good, and we just kind of did it. And I mean, at the time, I wanted to be Power Ranger, Ninja Turtle. I wanted to do something on TV with martial arts.
Yeah, of course.
And then my friends were really big into aggressive inline skating. It just got popular because the X Games was blowing up at the time.
Yeah.
So they were looking for a place to skate where they wouldn't get in trouble. And then the place that they found, one of the places they found was over in Northeast. And then they were told to move from that place. And as they were moving, they saw the Minnesota Cali sign. And because they used to be over in Northeast Minneapolis at that time. That whole area is different now. It's like real hipster now. But back then, that was where a good place for businesses to start. And then they told me about it and said, hey, let's go do it. Let's go live out our Van Damme dreams. So then we went, and after 3 months, they all stopped, and then I stayed. And I think it kind of goes down to what you were saying with Nat, because I remember Nat, because Nat was already, by the time I got to see Nat, he was past his prime. He was still really good, but he just wasn't, what he was in his youth. And I went there and I met a guy who fought. And that's what I didn't know about K1. I didn't know about anything until later. But that guy, I was like, you know what? I think I want to stay with this. I want to take a fight. But never knew where that would lead me down the road. But so funny that Minnesota Cali was your start. And you're right. It is. You couldn't even spar in Minnesota Cali at that time.
Yeah.
So it was different. So get back on track. So go ahead and I want to talk about the TBAs now. Now, for a lot of people listening to, I got a lot of people who are listeners from all over the world. And they want to know what it's like to go to TBAs. It's something that I mention here on a regular basis. It's the big Muay Thai tournament, the most consistent Muay Thai tournament that we've had here in the States. Go ahead and take us through your experience as a competitor and now your experience as a coach.
Oh, man. Well, it's so funny because I was fighting for Pete and Pam on their shows. Like, they used to do Round Kick Rumbles.
Yes.
And I was fighting on their shows like 2005, 2006, I think. And then maybe it was the first year it was technically a TBA tournament, 2007. And I fought on that, and it was an amazing tournament because everybody that went was really serious. I fought Eric Haycraft's wife, actually, in the final.
Lindsay. So you fought Lindsay. Lindsay Shear.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I won that fight, but it was a good, close fight. I mean, she was great. Obviously, she went on to do a lot of great stuff in kickboxing after her amateur career, even. But it was just a fraction of what it is now. I mean, that was 2007, and now it is this giant monster that has no sign of slowing down. It's awesome. But it was, I mean, and always Pete and Pam have been really, really well organized. You don't see some of the things, you know, some of these other tournament nightmares you see where there's, you know, people aren't fighting until 11 p.m. and there's all these. Inconsistencies with the bracketing and all that kind of stuff. They're always super duper organized. So they really do have it down to a science. That's for sure. But yeah, now it's like the level of competition. I mean, and you know this, if you've been there, a lot of those class A's would beat a lot of pros, I think, in America anyway.
That brings us to the next subject of how do you make it if you are a kickboxer in the United States? Now, one thing I was definitely pleased when I got the Glory job, I got messaged from a lot of people, you know, saying right person got the job, and that, you know, always makes you feel good when you hear stuff like that.
Yeah,
but
sure.
Like, one thing that I want to focus on with this is, all right, if you had a fighter from the beginning, you know, they want to know how to do Muay Thai, whatever, and we'll just go ahead and use your area. What would you tell them to do from the start? If the goal is to be the best in the world, let's just say we'll go ahead and go any weight class. We'll go light heavyweight. So in light heavyweight, the best in the world is Artem Vakhadov. The reason why I say light heavyweight is because I fought as a light heavyweight, and it was weird because if you go from a different sanctioning body, the weight class changes. It could be 209 to 201. You go to another one, it's 199 to 203. It was just so weird when I was coming up. So you've got a light heavyweight, Caitlin. He walks into the gym at the academy. What is your first goal as far as getting his career started to a pro career?
Well, you know, I think that really depends. I mean, it's going to be similar, but I think it really depends on if his goal is going to be kickboxing or Muay Thai somewhat. Maybe not right away. To be honest, I would tell them to make a visit training out of the country almost immediately to start those good habits early, and just a trip, you know, but it depends too, like how much focus they have, you know, if they're showing, like you said, if it's somebody who comes in who's a really serious athlete, it's clear they want to be the best in the world, and not necessarily to get them exposed to the coaching, though that is incredible too. I mean, we do our damnedest to compete with it in America, but at a certain point, we just don't have eyes that have seen as many matches. So I think training trips are super important. And then surrounding yourself with other serious fighters, and Eric Haycraft has done, a really interesting podcast talking about that. But I think training in Thailand, I would imagine training at good gyms in Europe is similar. Just seeing the level, that you should be turning at is really beneficial for fighters, I think. And it can be a big motivator. When they're thinking about, okay, like that's who I want to compete with. So that's what level I need to bring myself to. That would be one of the first steps, but consistency is really the big thing, I think. You know, whether it be like a light heavyweight, I maybe, you know, especially if they're thinking, because that weight class can do really well financially in kickboxing, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe Europe would be more likely for them. If it's a lighter weight class, maybe Thailand, depending.
You know, it's interesting because right now one of the things that I've been experiencing and in my own experience, I really wanted to make it. So I got to go to both Thailand and I lived in Holland for a little bit.
And, awesome. Oh, yeah. Yeah, so you've seen both.
Yes. And I'd say, and I also took a trip where I traveled through Europe. So I went to Leeds and I went to Bad Company and I just wanted to learn from everybody. Even after I was done fighting, I did it as a coach. And the one thing that I learned in being out there, I heard a podcast where Michael Corleone got a podcast, and he had a guy on there, and he was talking about how he wants to have a American that kicks as hard as the Thais. He says my goal is to, you know, get a guy that good. And for me personally, in my experience, we have an American that kicks as hard as the Thais. We have an American that punches as hard as anybody in the world. The thing that we struggle with is to understand the dance. You know, so if you go to Thailand, if you go against those guys, you think crosshook low kick's going to work on a Thai for 5 rounds? You know what I'm saying? Like they've seen it all. So the big thing that we've got to kind of focus on is getting better at the skill set of learning how to land effective offense consistently. And that's kind of what I do. I definitely focus on every fighter makes themselves. But one of the things that you said that really kind of clicked with me was people have to see it. That's one of the most important things. You've got to see why. Okay, is Holland better than us? Why is Holland better than us? Is Thailand better than us in Muay Thai? Why is Thailand? So in the way that you said that you asked the question of why can't we kick with a shin, we need more people to see what that highest level looks and feels like, and then you can kind of gauge from there.
Totally.
My question for you is, you mentioned visits and so on. How long would you recommend someone go to, like, for example, Thailand? Is Thailand something you got to do for 2 months? Is it something that you got to do for 2 weeks? Does it vary on the athlete? In your experience of having, you know, working with people who've gone over to Thailand before, what is your recommendation for how long they should go?
For Thailand, you know, again, and like, let's say we're talking about really serious competitors who are, because, you know, a lot of the time people think you're insane when you're like, I'm going to Thailand for 2 months. But I do think like a month is good, like at least a month, you know, and it depends. Like if you're early on in your career and you don't want to, this is maybe a little bit of a separate thing, but sometimes, you know, if you fight over there without pads, they don't want to let you back into tournaments here. So like as an amateur. So if you're not going to fight, you know, you maybe don't have to go as long. But I think a month or two is good because, you know, the first week is just, you've been there. It's like a joke. You're getting over your jet lag. It's super hot. You're trying to get used to the heat and humidity. But I do think it needs to be a significant amount of time. And I think it also has to be at a gym that isn't worried about making you 100% comfortable all the time. Though it's nice, you know, I think you can still learn at those gyms where you're going down to the beach every other day and that kind of thing. But if you're like,
oh, hold on. I think we lost her. We're going to get her right back. One moment.
Okay. Yeah. No, I was just saying, you know, again, it depends on the person. Like, I think it can still be beneficial for anyone, even if it's shorter. But I think for everybody's first trip, 3 weeks to a month is a good ballpark.
You said something really interesting that I thought, works really well with how I've been. One moment, folks. I got to fix this echo. Sorry, folks. I believe I got the echo out of there. Sorry about that. So one thing that Caitlin said that I really wanted to build on was she said, make sure you've got coaching staff that takes it serious. And this is right now in Thailand, they're in the era or the age of the tourist. So if you were to go in the 90s, you would almost have difficulty going to a lot of those gyms because they were so hardcore and there were there's a lot of money to be made. It was the golden age, but you had to be serious, serious. Every time they see Westerners, they think, okay, how serious is this person? Are they going to be drinking, fooling around with girls? Because all that stuff comes cheap and people don't know it. If you walk down the street, like in like Pattaya or something at night, the girls will literally reach out and grab you. You know, like you've got to be on your A game if you're going to be focused down there. And a lot of people aren't. So in the 90s, they were kind of against it. But now you go down there, everybody wants you. They want your tourist money. So they just kind of treat you like gold. But sometimes you get that Thai trainer that's just like, hey, and he's falling all over the place every time you throw a strike. That's not going to get you better. It really isn't. So you've got to get with somebody who... The best pad holder I ever had was when I went to, of all places, Golden Glory has a gym that they made down there, and they really put it together just because they wanted to, you know, get themselves ready for the K-1 World Grand Prix in that part of the world. And I went to that gym, and when I was at that gym, they had a pad holder, and he asked me right from the jump, he goes, are you a fighter? And I go, yes. And that completely changed how he held bits for me.
Yes.
And he was... I couldn't even, if I didn't kick in the middle of the pad, he yelled at me. And the first time he did it, I was like, this guy's legit. That was the first thing that went through my head. And at that period of time, I had, everybody used to call me AK1 because I was the biggest guy. They'd be like, AK1, you America, you real good at speed bag. Like everybody would like kind of give me praise. And I was doing good and I was working hard, but nobody was as critical as this guy. If you're going to spend the money to go all the way across the world, go ahead and make sure you've got somebody that is dedicated to getting you better. But if they're just bubbly with you and everything you throw is the most devastating thing in the world, you might need a new trainer, because it's not that you don't want to waste your time out there.
Absolutely, and that's 100% true. And I think it's something that people have a hard time with, you know, because like you can be in a somewhat higher position at your own gym here. And then you go there, and if you're at a good gym, you're going to be kind of a noob. I mean, relative to people who have been fighting professionally since they were 8 years old, 7 years old, you know. And I think that can be a hard pill for people to swallow, but if you just surrender to it and let them mold you, it can be, I really think, a life-changing experience.
So I'm going to go ahead and build on that and talk about practice a little bit more. What do you think in your experience? Now, again, and I'm going to go from a coach's perspective. I have seen everything work. I always explain it. When I tell someone something in class, I usually say, hey, well, try it this way or play with it this way. But if it's the human body. So if I do something fast enough at the human body, it's probably going to hurt it. So what I usually tell them is, if you get anything from me, advice-wise and so on, take it and add it to what you're already thinking and what you're already doing. Now, if you do something that's going to get yourself in trouble, I'm going to say it. But the thing that I wanted to ask you is this. I have seen the hardest of hardest sparring create champions, and I've seen play sparring and barely any sparring create champions. In your experience, when you have people come through the gym, how hard do you want them to experience the Muay Thai sport? Do you want practices with, you know, really, really hard as far as they need to feel the drain of it? In the early 2000s, that was all the rage in America. In America, if you went to Muay Thai class in the early 2000s to mid-2000s, you got a coach that was just trying to, like, work you to the ground. But as far as how much work that you're asking for someone as far as the sparring goes, as far as the physical, what your body endures, do you have a cutoff for it, or what is your kind of, how hard is too hard a sparring, or how hard do you guys go at your gym, or what is your preference for how you prepare athletes in this sport?
You know, I think early in my career, I was more into harder sparring, but I think with that, and this has just been my experience, there are some people that'll come in the gym not afraid of being hit. It's interesting. Like, some people just, you can't make them afraid of being hit. Even if after they get knocked out or cut bad, they won't be afraid. And then there are some people, I think if you hard spar them too early, they develop these bad habits that they can almost never let go of. They become too hesitant. What I tend to favor is really, really hard pads and bag work. Like, really difficult. Mm-hmm. But then, like, timing sparring. Hard clinch. but timing sparring. So everything else is really exhausting. So it forces them to relax and develop good, efficient technique. But the sparring, most of the time, and that's not to say we never do hard sparring, because we do here and there, but especially early, should be like playtime. Like, the way I always describe it is like if you went to school and you were just taking tests all the time without lessons. I like it when fighters develop a fearlessness about exchanging, get used to seeing shots without being too shy, and then like they can hard spar a little later once they're more comfortable with that. Or, you know, some don't need it. Like we've some of our amateurs, since we've kind of pulled back on that, like our finish rate has gone up significantly. So, and I think it's just because they're willing to try things and not feeling like they always have to rely on their A game to just sort of survive, you know, against more experienced people. Because you have more experienced teammates in the gym, but you're going to probably be fighting someone similar experience. So I think it can make them even shy of things that when they go to compete, they don't actually need to be shy of. But that's not to say that sometimes that is the answer for certain fighters. You know, they're so different. Each one can be a little different, but that's sort of the baseline we start with, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. You know, for me, in my experience, we do play sparring a lot. I turn it up here and there, but I want you to be able to do the techniques confidently. And I think that if you're afraid of, you know, the exchanges, like, for example, when I was coming up, the big gym in our area, Dave Manet was like my first fight coach. And when we were with him, he basically had a system of we would go and then we would do pad work. And then he'd show us something on the ground, and then we'd grapple. Like, that was the MMA system there. And I wanted to do kickboxing, so I would do that still, but then I would prioritize the first part of class. But one thing that I learned in our area, Miletich was the big gym coming up when I was coming up. Like, that was the big gym in the Midwest where people were having successful careers, not just in MMA, mostly in MMA, but in other avenues. It's like they called that gym for athletes. And that gym had people that couldn't necessarily throw the cleanest strikes, but they were all hardened to spar because they sparred so hard. And when I went to Duke's gym and I stayed out there, that was the first time where I did both, where I was like, where Duke prioritized being technical and then prioritized turning it up at different times. So the reason why I asked that question was, you know, it's something that everybody experiences differently, everybody grows and they, you know, as you said before, some people can take the hits and just keep going. And some people will turn away the moment you lift your hand up, you know. And I think that you kind of got to find the middle ground to get everybody better. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
So I'll go ahead and ask you, as far as your Muay Thai experience goes, you've gotten to fight for Lion Fight. You've gotten to fight for, other mixed martial arts organizations. But could you tell us a little bit more about your fight career and some of your favorite fight experiences in the Muay Thai sport?
Sure. Well, so I was amateur. That was my last amateur fight. Was a Thai boxing tournament that year. And then I went into MMA because it was so dried up. Mm-hmm. I think I preferred to probably stay stand-up, but there just weren't opportunities. And Greg and Andy at the academy were like, oh, why don't you try some MMA? So I kind of went into that.
For our listeners who don't know, Caitlin's got a victory over Misha Tate, a very fast victory over Misha Tate back in the day. So just so you guys know, I've been keeping it Muay Thai. I've been trying to keep her MMA out of it, but I got to give a shout-out to her for that victory.
Well, and even that, it was, I mean, I'd been doing jiu-jitsu 3 months. I was fresh off a Thai boxing thing. So I was like, well, I'm just going to go out there and Thai box and hope I don't get taken down. Which, luckily, it worked out that night, but I've had other fights where it didn't. So, but in any case, when I started coming back into Muay Thai and kickboxing, it was actually with WACO, which is World Organization of Kickboxing. World Association of Kickboxing Organizations, I believe.
Yes.
But they've done a bit more as of late. But they would occasionally call up American fighters to go fight on these cards in random places. And they had some smokers at the cellar, you know, because Justin and Chris are really big in WACO. And that's their gym here in the Twin Cities, we had some guys in their smoker fights. And then they were like, hey, there's a sparring tomorrow morning. So I was like, oh, okay, like, maybe I'll go to that. And I went and got some brunch with some girlfriends and rolled in. And I didn't realize it was supposed to be a Team USA tryout until I got there. But it was intense. It was like two-plus hours of sparring, 2 minutes on, 30 seconds off, just rotating through the whole time. But after that, they said, you know, how would you like to fight in Russia this summer? And I said, all right, I would do that, you know. And that was a really awesome experience. One of my favorite experiences ever, fighting, period, actually. It was kind of insane. It was actually really insane. It was held at a festival on a resort about 25 kilometers outside of Moscow.
Crazy.
And I had never left the country, you know, other than Canada at that point. And I, you know, flew over there. It was, I mean, there were armed guards in eagles' nests and stuff. It was pretty amazing. But there were like 5,000 people there, and it was aired on their ESPN. And you know, they do what they do to you. And this is something, I'm sure we'll get back into this, when you're a pro fighting in America, it's really hard to stay busy. So you're going to find yourself in positions like this where you're going to fight somebody in their hometown. But they of course, changed the opponent the last 24 hours and all that. But I had a great time. I ended up winning UD. But it was great. It was like a 5-round fight. And on this ring that was like put up on logs outside, it was just awesome. Just one of those crazy, awesome experiences.
Man, that's amazing. You know, it's crazy because we're going to get into the career part, the pro part of it in a moment. But one thing that you talked about was the experience. And now I've got to ask this question. How much do you think a Muay Thai and kickboxing career here in the States should be about experience? And how much of it do you think should be about making money? And here's why I say it. Since I've been following and fall in love with Muay Thai and kickboxing, for me it started about 98-99, and then I really fell in love with it in 2001. For me, I've seen two countries emerge that weren't that great that became kind of great in Muay Thai and kickboxing. One of them was Russia. When I was in the 90s, there wasn't a lot of Russian athletes. I'm not saying that there wasn't zero, I'm saying there wasn't a lot. But all right. Of a sudden in the 2000s, the combination of like Artem Levin, he fought pro, and then whenever they do big amateur events, he'd fight amateur too. So he did both. And that allowed guys, just through the development of, they play with play sparring all the time out there, and they switch stance all the time out there. So now you've got guys like Artem Vakhadov and Artem Levin, guys who are really good, who can switch stance, and the country now produces high-level fighters on a regular basis. That wasn't the truth. When I first started, that wasn't the case. There was like Alexei Ignashov, and he's from Belarus. But like, you know, it's just, that was kind of it. The other country I'd say is China. China was an afterthought. Zhu Yong was like the only guy internationally kickboxing that I knew of. But now, flash forward 2017, they've got events. They pay a lot of money. There's only like 8 channels in the whole country, and it's all government owned. So if you get on TV, you're doing really well as far as advertisers and so on. The reason why I bring these examples up, as someone who is pursuing the sport, and Eric Haycraft had said something about this recently, where I think he talked about how maybe people in the U.S. should stay amateur longer, just for the experience. For you to have a consistent fight experience, I should say. I don't want to, I hope I'm phrasing him correctly. He was saying to make sure that you keep getting fights, you should stay amateur because it keeps you getting fights. How much of this do you think should be people focusing on just having great experiences like you had in Moscow? And how much of this should be people saying, you know what, if this sport is ever going to take off, we've got to prioritize more people going pro? Do you have a middle ground there? Do you say only focus on experience if you get someone new? Or do you say dream for the stars and try to make money in this thing?
Oh, man. You know, the way I look at it, and I mean, this is maybe not true of everybody in MMA, but even MMA to some degree. And I say that because, again, like, we're not talking about MMA, but the money is a lot better in MMA. And particularly as a female, I don't know of too many other sports that are on par, like, for men's and women's pay scale. So I think it's twofold, really. I mean, I think it is the experiences, and I think one of the things that hurts us the most in America, and I don't mean to rag on commissions, but that's part of it, is that it's so expensive to do shows in some states. It's prohibitive. And as a result, there's less opportunity. And with less fighters fighting, we end up really on the bad side of an experience gap. So for that reason, it can be hard to stay busy as well. And I get where Eric Haycraft is coming from on that, saying they should stay amateur. However, I do think all those pads change the game, and amateur experience isn't quite the same as pro experience. Because there are some things that do not work the same without shin pads on. And I think it's important to get those experiences as well. But I do think the state of things now, you can make a little bit of money fighting as a professional, but for the most part, your money will be made residually from that, you know, private lessons, seminars. If you open a gym one day, that's probably where you're going to make more money long term from it. And as a result, that's why I think those experiences are so important, because that's where you learn so much from it. There's nothing wrong with fighting in your hometown, but if you go and make yourself uncomfortable, fight in these crazy situations, fight in these tournaments like IF Man Wacko, and, you know, as you had mentioned, Artem Levin was doing, that's where you do get that really well-rounded experience, and it makes you a better fighter overall, so that if you are in a position where more opportunity comes up, that you can take full advantage of it. So I sort of think it's twofold, but I do think we can do more to make it popular here. And part of that is that I think Thai boxers and kickboxers tend to be really humble and tend to be a little bit shy. But I think fans get more interested in you if you put yourself out there a bit. And I think that's something everybody's been a little bit hesitant to do, but it can be helped.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on all fronts there. Got to work for you, you know, and there are some great personalities, and there are people who are super funny in the gym, and then there are people who you're like, you know what, you could be so much more than an entertaining fighter, you know, like you could really, yep. One of the guys who I train in this area, his name is Myron Dennis, and he's fought in Glory, and he was on the Ultimate Fighter, and he comes down from Oklahoma to train with me. He fought a guy recently, and he beat the guy. The guy was pretty much all grappler, and he couldn't take him down, so Myron was able to beat him on the feet. But the guy, before they fought, he wanted to be a professional wrestler, and he made this promo for the fight, just that he put up on YouTube, and in the promo, he's talking about how he wanted to make it to the WWE and be a professional wrestler, but now since he's not going to make it, he's going to, you know, fight Myron Dennis, he's going to beat him, and so on. When I saw that promo, I was like, how great is this? You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. Again, it didn't reflect his skill set, but in my mind, I'm like, this guy just sat out, made himself a wrestling promo for the MMA fight that he's going to take. And I'm like, I'll remember you. I don't remember any of Myron's other opponents. As soon as we beat him, I kind of forget about him until their name comes up again. But
right,
like,
right, of course.
But like that guy, I was like, as soon as he told me about, we were talking about it, I was like, man, that video was excellent that kid made. It was so funny. But we do need more of that. We do need more. I think the reason why MMA is popular, in my personal opinion, as a guy who's kind of watched it emerge, two things. One, of course, we've got successful Americans in it. That matters a lot.
Yeah.
To have successful Americans at the top, your Dillashaws, like that matters a lot. I mean, clearly a Conor McGregor type figure, that's once in a lifetime. You can't predict something like that. But like on the consistent level, there's people who in America who are in wrestling right now who look to mixed martial arts and they see an American star and they can relate to them. So I think that that's a big part of it. Whereas in kickboxing, there's not a lot of U.S. names at the top. And you can see how that's a little bit different. We're very, as niche a sport as combat sports is, Muay Thai and kickboxing are niche sports inside of combat sports. So I definitely agree with that part. I understand that part. But one of the things that I was thinking about with
Artem Levin. I was thinking about with some of those other examples and kind of what you were saying before. Well, Artem's okay experience because Artem comes out dancing and stuff like that, whatever. There's something more to who you are as a fighter. And if you can get that portrayed as well as your fight skill, people will want, they'll want to see you win or want to see you lose. And right now, that's, I mean, it's unfortunate, but you can move up the ranks faster with that mentality than you can just by beating really good guys. So yep. It's just kind of how it's always going to be. Before we leave the amateur scene and focus mainly on pros for the questions, I have one more question for you. What is your thoughts on the IFMAs? Because when I first got into this, they were not around, and then they emerged. And actually, the first few events were huge. Like I remember one of them was in Thailand, and I remember Artur Kashinko was like one of the better fighters in the world at the time. He went down there and won a fight, and I remember it's because we didn't have Twitter back then. We were all fight forums. We were fight forum lovers, and that's how you found stuff out. But when IFMAs first started, it was huge. That's when I first found out who Valentina Shevchenko was and that kind of deal. Joanna Jędrzejczyk. I knew them for their Muay Thai resumes. What is your thoughts on... Now, IFMA is a little bit different, still has a lot of participants, but not what it was back in 2006, 7, 8. Like, it was huge in those first ones, but still pretty big. What is your thoughts on it and just that huge amateur... It's not really amateur. It's just you do it for free, but that huge platform to be in the IFMAs.
I think it's great. I mean... It gives people the opportunity to compete, you know, against some really good talent, and it's one of the few where, you know, I think the men's divisions sometimes have two classes, but the women's it's only elite. It gives people, you know, the opportunity to compete, but you know, again, it's a really fascinating thing because other countries they pay out big if you medal.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where it sort of highlights the difference between maybe even just how combat's worked are valued in the U.S. compared to Thailand or Turkey or somewhere else. But so I think it's awesome. And, you know, we've had a couple guys do it and have a great time. But I also think it's really important to note that it is not Thai scoring that's happening. It's Thai rules, as in all Thai boxing techniques are allowed, but it isn't scored the way a traditional Thai boxing fight is scored in Thailand. I think that we've heard some stuff from the head coach of the Thai boxing team about this, and it's probably shifting in so that more countries can compete well, but it is a slightly different sport than Thai boxing, I think.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I do think that they kind of score it more like the West scores it. Yep. For those who are wondering kind of what she's talking about, if you're in Thailand, the best way I explain it to people is I say they value the hardest strike or the most difficult strike high, and they value the easiest strike low. So, for example, if you are using boxing on someone, if you don't knock them out, they won't rank it high. So if you went out and you scored a bunch of jabs, they won't rank that high if you're in Thailand. But the body kick, which is, you know, something, a staple in Thailand, because it can be checked, because it can be caught, because you can slide out of the way of that, if you can score a body kick consistently, it'll rank really high. It'll score really high if you can get a body kick in. Low kick, they'll score it somewhat, but you've got to hurt them with a low kick. If you don't hurt them with the low kick, then they won't score it as high. So for the clinch, if you get dominated in the clinch, they're going to score. They'll say you're getting dominated. You're going to be down in the cards because of that. If you're throwing elbows, they'll say, oh, you're being diverse. If you're missing strikes all the time, they'll say, oh, you're making them look like a fool. The way they score it in Thailand is usually based on that. In the West, we almost score it like boxing with kicks. Whatever yeah. The strongest, most significant score, the score that I call them the sexy shots, the person who scores the shots that we remember the most, that person almost always wins the round. So sometimes I'll watch like a kickboxing card, and the way they scored in America will just drive me crazy because one person will score all the consistent kickboxing, and then the other person will try like some spinning kick that gets blocked, and then it'll be the only thing that the judge remembers, and then they'll give them the round. Drives me crazy. So if you go to the IFMAs, the one thing that you do want to worry about is sometimes that person who's out there landing the kickboxing, that person's, you know, might be winning. And it is a little bit different. So you definitely got to be prepared. Really try to watch other fights and get a gauge on how they're scoring it. That's the thing I always try to recommend to everybody.
Right. Well, and the forward pressure, too, is a thing. Oh, I think that IFMA is really scores high, where in Thailand it can be taken as desperate.
Yep.
And then of course in Thailand they'll score the fight as a narrative rather than round by round. Mm-hmm. And that's just something that's a whole different issue, in that it's really tough for Westerners to get any practice in that scoring system, because it essentially doesn't exist, or at least to my knowledge, there's no organization that scores that way outside of Thailand, I don't think.
For sure, and it's weird because for those who are wondering what she's talking about, what they mean by narrative is this. They'll score the round, every round that there's a fight, they'll score the round, but they'll like put a little note by it, you know? So like the best example I can remember is someone, there's a Muay Thai fight, and round one took place. And I remember here in the States, a lot of people will say, I worked some events in Oklahoma and something and so on. And they'll say, well, in Thailand, they never score the first two rounds. That's not true. Now, they want the betting to build up. But like, if you were to take a hard shot, they might go, okay, there was a really hard punch landed in that round. I'm going to call the round. But narrative, I'm going to go ahead and put Yotsen Klai, a check by Yotsen Klai, because he landed that shot. But I'll go ahead and, you know, score 10-10 with a check by Yotsen Klai. And then when you get into three rounds, three and four, which of course are the rounds where people usually try to take it, those are the rounds that have the most action, so people usually score those the highest. But don't think that the refs are just eating, you know, fruit for the first two rounds. They're scoring the whole fight as a narrative, and they're scoring the rounds in one and two. But what happens in three and four and early in five, it, because that's the most action, that's usually the one that determines the winner. But for whatever reason, I've just been working cards where people say, they don't score the first two rounds in Thailand, and it just drives me crazy.
No, yeah. It's hilarious. Yeah, no, it's funny. They look at it as a whole, like, what story does it tell? So it's really fascinating kind of seeing the direction things are taking, and I think because people want it in the Olympics so bad, things are changing a little bit more even, it seems, from I'm sort of on the periphery, but it seems that way.
And I do think we're a good fit for the Olympics. Muay Thai is a good fit for the Olympics. I think that there's enough, we've got enough of a body that takes care of itself, you know, as far as we've got enough people internationally that are involved with, like, the FMS and so on. That if we got the right country to give it a shot, you know, I mean, if Japan's not giving us a shot, it's going to be tough, but we've got the right kind of country. England is when they introduced the women's boxing. You know, when women's boxing was first introduced in England, and I was like, okay, man, that's really, really good. The tides are changing. Now we're going to get the opportunity to get Muay Thai in because we really do have the athletes. Now, of course, they're going to have to make it something similar to basketball where pro athletes can do it as well. It won't be like the boxing system where they're all amateurs. I know that's going to be a little bit tougher, but I think you're right. I think that getting more international involvement makes it easier to continue to grow the sport in a way that it's very important that the average person can sit down, watch the sport, and determine who the winner is. You can't be like, all right, let's go to our three resident scientists to tell us who won this fight. It's got to be, if I'm watching a fight and I've never seen the fight before, when the fight's over with, I've got to be able to tell you who the winner is. That's just kind of always how it has to be. And I think that the IFMA scoring is trying to move in that direction.
Yes, and I watched the Thai boxing at World Games in summer, and it was neat because they showed the score after every round, which I think it makes it more interesting to the fans, in that they can kind of see how things are happening, and this guy or girl either needs a knockout or what have you to pull it off, or is it really close? So I think that's something that will probably help garner interest, actually.
For sure. And I work for Glory Kickboxing, and they're doing open scoring too. And, you know, they don't do it in all locations, but they've been doing it a lot more. And so sometimes you know if there's some urgency. It helps with our sport because we don't have as many rounds. If you do three and five rounders, it's easier to do. Whereas if you've got like a 12-round boxing match, if a guy's down 7-1, he might be like, well, I ain't trying anymore. You know? you know? Yeah. But like for us, if you lose the first round and your coaching staff can look up and see, you know, okay, we lost that one, time to pick it up, it can make for a more exciting fight. I definitely agree. Let's go ahead and stay, move fully into the pro realm. You talked about how, as far as making money goes, as far as avenues in mixed martial arts and so on, as far as making money, there's something that a trend that I've seen in some of the cards that you work up there in Minnesota, and something that's happening down here in Texas. And I'm just starting to see it more and more all over the country. People are doing Muay Thai fights or kickboxing fights in cages alongside of mixed martial arts fight cards. In your opinion, how has this helped kickboxing and Muay Thai grow? Because for us, there are really good fighters that might not fight each other in the area because they've got good MMA records. But if you say, hey, do you want to do this fight in Muay Thai? They're down to do it in Muay Thai. And then maybe they fall in love with it and they want to do Muay Thai a few more fights. But in your personal opinion, how do you view and how do you see this addition of Muay Thai and kickboxing in the cage and how it adds on to experiences and pro opportunities for fighters in the country?
I think, well, first of all, a lot of promoters have been mostly doing MMA, so, like, I can just speak to the situation up here. I've been matchmaking for a promoter that I fought for in MMA. And then I transitioned back to Thai boxing and wanted to fight. And I said, hey, what would you think about doing some kickboxing fights? So I don't think that it would have been it would have been far more of a risk for him to say yes and then throw in on an all kickboxing card right away. So I think it really helped in that it helps, like, the promoters and even just the fan base in the area sort of test the waters. And maybe you can expose them to kickboxing or Muay Thai before you try to market that event all by itself and have them saying, well, what is this Muay Thai? They don't know. Mm-hmm. So I think it really, for instance, our next show is going to be all Muay Thai in a ring, but we've really been able to kind of ease the transition so that hopefully some of the interest has followed over from MMA, and some of the people going to those shows have started getting to know people that only do Thai boxing here. Because we do have, and you know this, you've lived up here, like an amazing talent pool
mm-hmm.
of Thai boxers up here. But there just hasn't really been much of an outlet in the area until recently. And I think doing it that way, you know, and obviously it saves on the venue cost and the cost of staffing it and that sort of thing. But I think minimizing the risk helps promoters feel a little bit safer testing the water.
And I definitely think that's been the thing that I've seen down here. And more and more people are asking for it. And when you put on great fights, and I mean, really, that's what it comes down to. You know, one of my fighters who does MMA, his skill set is so based off of, he could be a great Muay Thai fighter or kickboxer. Like, he's got a style that, you know, Glory, we don't have his weight class. He's about 135, 130-ish. So my goal, of course, is to get him to Japan one day. But he finally had his first Muay Thai fight, his debut. And in it, he was throwing elbows like crazy. And it's cool. It's cool to see that kind of happen. And we were given the platform because an MMA promotion who's been doing it for a really long time in our area, they, you know, decided that, okay, we're doing okay with MMA, but we've got some people that are interested in Muay Thai. We've got a square cage anyways. Let's give it a shot. And now the Muay Thai fights are main eventing, and then it's still a mixed card, so there's still MMA in there and so on. And it's really good for me because now I can get my athletes seen. And then when I do my first show down here, which I just found out today, it's going to be in March.
Exciting.
Oh, yep. It was going to be in December, but then we realized it's just too close to Christmas, and we couldn't risk it. Because
nobody's going to like, oh, wait.
Exactly. Don't want to cut weight. And even worse, people are like, oh, I got to, you know, use money to buy a present for so-and-so. So I was like, you know what? I don't know if I want to take my chance around Christmas. I can't be messing with Jesus' day. So we decided that we were just going to postpone it. But one of the things that helps as far as selling your athletes and building a fan base is to have someone do what you guys are doing in Minnesota, and what we're getting down here with the XKO promotion. If they're doing Muay Thai and kickboxing, it is an easier way to introduce it. And so now people are liking the fights, and they've been main eventing, and it's been a lot of fun. So we're just going to build off of that. I'm going to go ahead and segue into one of the main questions that I wanted to talk about, because we're on the subject.
Sure.
And I talked about it a little bit earlier my podcast a couple months ago. There are questions that people have about the sport, problems that they have about the sport. One of the big ones is, why do fighters have to sell tickets? And I've seen arguments on both sides, so I'll go ahead and give you the first argument and just get your take on it. This is the argument for why a fighter shouldn't sell tickets. I think some fighters really just want to focus on the fight of it, the competition of it. They want to put the time in. They just want to go out there and execute to the best of their abilities. For them, it takes away from their training, their preparation. If they've got to go around to this person, this person, this person, run down tickets, run down, people who are not necessarily bad, it doesn't make them an evil person, whatever, but for them to try to focus on what it takes to sell tickets in order to get a fight on a card, they feel like that takes from them. They feel that hurts their ability, that hurts their chances to win. And if they focus so much on getting people to the fight and not enough time on the preparation part, they feel like it takes away from their performance. And if they lose in the end, the promoter still wins because they got the ticket sales, but this fighter didn't get to compete to the best of their ability. So before we talk about the other side of it, because you and I have been on both sides of it, what are your thoughts about people or athletes, go ahead and say something in favor of why someone might have this kind of thought process of why they can't just focus on performing to the best of their ability and not have to focus on ticket sales. So that the XKO promotion that I mentioned, they just do all of everything. Like here in the state, they sell themselves. They can literally headline a fight card with two guys with negative records because they just sell the fight event and they sell the fight action. So it can be done if a promoter does it, but let's go ahead and focus on, from a fighter's point of view, can you make an argument to help out somebody who says, man, I just want to focus on the fight?
Yeah. Well, and I get that, man. It's not the easiest thing. And I think promoters can do things to make it easier on them. Like, for instance, up here we have cage ticks. So if you don't want to run these tickets to your aunt's house or whatever, you can tell them to get them there. But I think something that they need to understand is, regardless of if a promoter tells you whether or not you need to sell tickets, they're paying attention to what you sell. So, if you're bringing people in the door, you're going to get more opportunities. And you might still get fights without it. And this is the thing is, you very well may get fights without it, but you're kind of securing your spot if you make sure that you're helping cover the cost of your fight. And I think what some fighters don't understand, it's like, before you move out of your mom's house, you don't realize, like, the added cost of paper towels and Ziplocs and all that.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of look at it the same. I mean, depending on what the promotion does. But for instance, if you got a promotion who's covering a significant amount of insurance, maybe more than what they're required to do by the commission. Like up here, fighters do get a percentage of their tickets, a decent percentage. There's the venue, there's paying travel for somebody else to come in who's an appropriate match. I'm not just throwing you with somebody who happens to be your same weight, but might be, 10 fights apart early in your career. So there are things that when a fighter invests in the promotion is more likely to invest in that. And I know some promotions go way over the top with it. They really do, pressuring on the ticket sales. Because it's certainly not the only thing. But if they want to be, considered and prioritized, like, it's a business, of course. So if you have one fighter who, yes, like, they might go out there and be a killer, but, people have off fights here and there, and while it should be performance-dependent to a certain degree, somebody that's investing back in the promotion is going to be a priority, regardless. So I think it's a complex issue. I don't agree that the promotion should rely entirely on the fighters for it, but especially where we are right now in Muay Thai and kickboxing, I feel it has to be a group effort to get it rolling.
Yeah, and I definitely think that's the case. And One thing that I've experienced kind of watching it, it's, or the way that I try to explain it to people is this. Clearly, people who show up are coming to see a combat sports brand. But the more you can sell yourself as an individual, the more, as you said before, you can secure your spot. They'll invest into you. Because in the end, people have no idea how expensive these things can get sometimes for fight promotions and so on. So for us, the big thing was, you know, we had to make sure we found a place. I don't drink alcohol at all, but we had to find a place where we could sell alcohol because people who watch fights drink alcohol.
You want a beer, yeah.
You know, so it's like that's a big part of it. So we've got to make sure that's something that we've got to take care of with the states. We've got to pay a licensing fee just to be able to do shows. So you got to have that in. And the way that a fighter has to have a fighter's license, it's way more to have a promoter's license in our state, in Texas. So you go ahead and you get those. Insurance, that's a big part of it. Now we drug test down here. That's something that another thing that we've got to focus on as far as paying in Texas. There are so many added costs to, I mean, a lot of people got to find volunteers and say, hey, you can have a free seat if you can come help set up chairs. There's so much that goes into this that understand that you could be a person that just take care of yourself, but when it comes time to cashing it, you know, them using the second fight around, the second card comes around, and you only took care of yourself, you went out there, you had a great performance, don't be upset if they don't call your name the next time around. They've got to, every promotion lives to sell itself. Like that's what they do. They need to make it to another show. If you wonder why Conor McGregor or Ronda Rousey has a little bit more say, it's because the UFC needs to sell. They're not dumb. These guys are bringing in the money. I'm going to go ahead and bend a little bit, see if I can work something out. This person's brought me money. So if you are Joe Schmo who's just trying your best and beating fighters, you're going to run into difficulty having an advantage over other people when it comes down to making your case argument-wise for fighting more. Because a promoter, for whatever reason, at some period of time, people started to feel like the promoter's main priority should be upholding the integrity of the sport, and that's not their role. Because they could uphold the integrity and run out of money. Their main role is to exist for themselves. So if you ever look at a matchup, like even this, you know, what was it, last weekend, George St. Pierre and Michael Bisping. Michael Bisping didn't fight for a whole year waiting on that fight, because he thought it was a big fight and he ended up, you know, losing the fight. But in the end, he waited because he thought it was the best financial benefit to him. And the UFC allowed him to do it because they thought it was their best financial benefit. If you're one of the guys in the top 10, I can see you being upset and being like, this is trash. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're being overlooked. So I understand that. And I've been on both sides of it. You know, when I coached Johnny Hendricks, after we beat Fitch, we thought we were going to get a title shot after every fight. We ended up fighting 4 more fights before we got the GSP shot. So I understand how people can be like, no, the promoter should care about just good performances and good hard fighters. But you got to understand how much money, especially on a local level, our level, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You got to understand how difficult it is to put those shows on. And if you can't sell for you, if your people don't want to see you fight, I mean, it just should tell you a little bit about what's going on, because boxing's history is still built on, you know, local attractions. You know, so I think everybody should prioritize selling themselves, not just selling tickets, but selling themselves. It gives you an opportunity to do both.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, again, it doesn't even have to be a super crazy, you know, because you do hear that from fighters like, oh, I need to focus. But it can just be a little bit. It can be a Facebook post here or there. Mm-hmm. But I think it matters, too, if promoters see that you're trying. And, yeah, I think even if they see that you're trying and then your guy pulls out and, you know what, you're an amateur, but with hotel and gas money and all this stuff, it's going to cost them $500 to $1,000 to make sure you get matched on this card. They're going to look at that differently if you're somebody who's been putting in the effort versus somebody who just has been silent and training in the gym. Like, we like to assume everyone's training, right? But you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, I think as frustrating as it is, and you hear the argument, like, promoters are the one who promote, like, yes, they do that too, but they also secure the venue and the sanctioning body, and they organize everything, and they set it up, and they take on all of the risk. really all the risk. I think if you can do things to lighten that load, you'll make yourself a priority. And really, you are still doing more for your own career that way. I mean, I think having a good relationship with your local promoter is one of the best things you can do for a fight career, bar none. Whether that's MMA or Muay Thai or kickboxing or boxing, either way, you know, have a good, especially if it's a solid stand-up person who's had a lot of good shows that haven't canceled. I think having a good relationship with that promotion is one of the best things you can do.
For sure, and you explained it so well when you just talk about all the different things that go into putting together a fight card. And really, fighters don't realize this. On fight day, all you have to do is show up and fight. On that day, a promoter's got everything in the world going through their head, you know. So, and then one more thing I'd say just to people as advice, give it to someone else. Like give your ticket selling to someone else. The last time I was up in Minnesota for a fight, Cooley fought a kid from North Carolina on one of Jeremy's cards. We fought, I can't remember where it was. I can't think of the name of the place, but they did a good job of filling the place up. But Cool, he had a huge fan base because, you know, he's Hmong and he had a lot of family and so on in the area. And he told his wife that he's fighting, and she put together this poster where it was like the sexy Asian sensation. And she went out and she did all his ticket sales and so on. If it's not your thing, find the friend who can do it for you. Find your mom, find your so on. Don't make it yours. If you're worried that it's going to take away from your training, your so on, find somebody to do it for you. They'll do it. You know, you can, because people in this niche sport where we get into, you know, where we hit each other, there is someone who wants to see you succeed, and they will take things to, you know, responsibilities from you to make this happen for you. So, but that's just my recommendation. So go ahead, Caitlin, we'll go ahead and wrap the show up with a couple questions. First, who are some of your favorite fighters to watch?
man. I really enjoy Singmini.
Mm-hmm.
I really like watching how well Robin Van Roosmalen plays the short man game.
Yes.
That's the kind of stuff that I find like so intriguing to watch, is when they do a really, really good job of it. Yeah, in terms of glory, those guys like Jason Wilnes and those guys out of the Coliseum, in part because I just love watching how well that coach game plans over a 3-round fight. It's incredible. And then on the Thai side, I really enjoy watching why am I drawing a blank? Her name.
There's a lot of them, so I'm not sure.
No, I know.
I can help you. We got Kaylee Reese. We got Nissan.
Saucing.
Okay, yes.
I love watching the way she fights. But yeah, there are just so many. But my favorite thing is when it's somebody who just plays their game plan, like whatever it is for their body, like uses whatever their gifts are to the best of their ability. Just awesome.
So, the last question I have for you is, what was your favorite fight? Like, as a competitor, what was your favorite fight? It could be wins or loss, doesn't matter, but what fight do you feel like you look back on and you go, this was the best version of Caitlin Young, and this was the best version of who I went against? And, oh, you know what, I'll make it a two-part question. What fight reflected the best version of Caitlin Young, and what fight do you say, man, this, we tore the house down with this performance?
Probably my best fight as a pair was with Claire Baxter in March. She's really good Aussie who's been living in Thailand and training and fighting there. And she happened to be in the States. I just posted on a forum like, hey, does someone want to fight me in March? And she came to Minnesota, and to be honest, I think that fight like helped us pushing along Muay Thai up here so well. She's awesome, and so it's a really good, really good close fight. I don't want a decision, but it's a good fight. I think we might rematch here in Thailand this winter. And then One of my better performances, when I felt the most on, I would have to say I had another fight in Thailand a few weeks after that. I was just kind of really on fire at the time, and I didn't play the game I normally play. I stayed out rather than doing pressure because she was so damn strong, and I just knew I wasn't going to win in the tie-up. But her name was, Daodon, and she was awesome. So I've had a couple of fun ones as of late.
Cool. Well, everyone, this was Caitlin Young. I want to thank you so much for being on the show, talking, you know, kickboxing and Muay Thai with me. You've got a show coming up in January. Go ahead and promote it so that if anybody's in the area, they can check you out.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it's going to be January 20th. It's going to be our first all full rules Muay Thai show here up in Irvine. And it'll be live on Flow Combat, actually. Also, and I would imagine you have a fair amount of Texans. Jacob Rodriguez is going to be in the co-main event as well out of Houston Muay Thai against our guy Tom Jenkins, who was on the last show, had an epic body shot KO. So, and then Ben Locken and Vlad, oh my gosh, I'm going to butcher his last name. Good Canadian out of Dave Zuniga's gym. Vlad Damazov, I'm not even going to try.
Yep.
Their headline. So it'll be good stuff, and we have a lot of fights. About half the fights are female fights too.
Okay,
so it should be good stuff.
And where are you guys? Tell everybody where you're at. Where are the fights going to be at?
They're going to be at Canterbury Park, the horse racing place. So
okay, cool. Canterbury Park. For those who are wondering, it is that would be just outside of Minneapolis.
Yeah, Shakopee. Just outside of Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, my viewers, I'm sure once I post this on Facebook, I'm going to have your name in it, and definitely they'll need to know. I mean, you and I know where Shakopee is, but
not everybody, yes.
Yeah, somebody from England's not going to know that, but they might know Minneapolis, so that's why I say outside the city. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Caitlin. Thank you so much to all my listeners, and I was so grateful to have Caitlin on. One more thing, Caitlin, is there any thank yous that you want to give? I like to give the last part, not a question, just to you to say thank you to blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, absolutely. First, thank you so much. Like a lot of what we talk about, Jeremy Bjornberg up here, for taking a chance on Thai boxing. You know, my teammates at the academy, and even all the local and regional Muay Thai teams that are really putting in the effort to make this possible. And then for my own career, Karmpet Petrachapat, Deseret Gym, and my sponsors, MMA Roadhog, Menacing Valor, Mr. Mouthguard, keeping my teeth in my mouth, obviously, for making it possible to head over to Thailand and get it done over there.
Awesome. Well, that is Caitlin Young, everybody. I will be back next week. Again, I'll choose another topic that I think people come up with. We really just got to talking about everything there to do with U.S. Kickboxing and Muay Thai, and then we touched the topic a little bit. Next week, I'm going to talk about judging and the people who have difficulty with it, the people who understand it. That'll probably be my topic of conversation as I go through the questions that people have in the sport. But once again, we are joined by Caitlin Young. Thank you so much. Definitely check Caitlin out. Go to her show if you can, and if she works for Invicta, as a matchmaker. So if you get the opportunity, watch some Invicta fights. You might see her chilling in the audience. One of my favorite moments of, I'm going to go ahead and I was going to save these and tell her off air, but I'm going to tell her on air my two favorite Caitlin Young experiences. All right. I went to a Muay Thai event. I can't even think of where it was, but it was my first time seeing her fight. And you had other teammates on it. Murray was there. I don't think Nat was fighting, but after you guys had fought, everybody, all you guys were kind of like standing in the back and you're all lined up and you all had your arms crossed. And I was like, who are they? And I know you guys are just kind of being teammates and hanging out, but like, I was going to check the sport out, because Phil Nurse was actually there. So basically, Phil Nurse had brought some fighters from New York, and the card was split. And I remember Murray, he had dropped his guy with low kicks, but his guy was tough, and he kept getting back up. And then I can't think of the other teammates you had, but I was almost certain that I watched you fight that day too. And I remember just after the event was over with, you guys were all chilling in the back and your arms were crossed. And I was like, who are these guys? So
that's funny. I wonder what show that was.
Yep. So do I. It was a while ago, but I always remember, cause that was my first time seeing Phil Nurse. And what people don't realize is if you see Phil Nurse corner someone in Muay Thai, he does a trick every time he gets into the ring. So, like, he'll spin through the middle of the ropes or he'll flip over the top. Like you got to see it. But it's probably the most athletic thing you'll see on the whole fight card, including the fights. You know, of course, he's older, so he's still doing that kind of stuff. So, that's my first experience. And my number two experience, and again, I usually try to keep this show stand-up, but in one of my fighters who I used to work with, her name was Jenyu Fry, and she fought for the title with a girl named Ayaka, who's like the best in the world, 105, and we fought like a year ago. And in that fight, Jin was winning the fight, and then Ayaka caught her with a big shot, but the shot landed in such a way that it cut Jin. Now, the cut was bad, but I thought Jin could have fought. And I think that if Jin was a guy, I'm not going to lie, if Jin was a guy, I think they would have let her fight. Especially because we were towards the end of the round. You could have got her on the stool and so on. And all of a sudden, I hear someone just yelling, like, just, you know, what are you stopping it for? Let her in. And I go over, and I'm thinking it's one of my corner. And it is Caitlin Young yelling at the ref from outside of the cage. And I'm like, all right, I'm all about Caitlin Young.
Oh, I fell for it. It didn't make any sense to me, being so close. It's not like the blood was even in her eye yet.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Oh, well, that's just funny. A sport.
That you're a part of that.
Oh, I remember, I mean, I think most of us coaches are a little bit crazy, but I remember all of that kind of stuff. So thank you again for being on the podcast. And
thank you so much.
Hey, it's been a lot of fun, and I will continue to send fighters your way and hopefully get fighters from you. And Caitlin said something great off the air when we were talking about if Muay Thai and kickboxing is going to grow. Now, I'm so grateful for this role that I have with Glory. And I'm also grateful that with, you know, one of my old fighters, Cody Pfister, I'm able to now start putting on shows. We've got to come and do this together. There's only so many of us. So if there's someone who is fighting, right now she's doing a show in Minnesota, but maybe you train Muay Thai in North Dakota or South Dakota or Montana and you hear about this show, and we'll do our best. You contact them. We'll see what we can do as far as, you know, because really it's just
us. A small community of people who really love kickboxing, really love to see the sport do well. We love Muay Thai. We love the stand-up arts. So definitely be in contact with Caitlin Young if you're in the Midwest, as I mentioned before, Iowa. If you're in, you know, either the Dakotas, if you're in Wisconsin, if you're in, you know, Illinois, contact her. Maybe she can get you something. Definitely contact me if you are, you know, around or in Texas or around the Texas area. We want to do our best, and you know, maybe you're not in any of those areas at all, but maybe we could help you as far as talking to a promoter in your area. Maybe he could start putting on Muay Thai fights in the cage. But really, the Muay Thai kickboxing community, it's very, very small, but it's very dedicated, and there's a lot of people who love the sport who went into mixed martial arts because, you know, there's more opportunities there, more money there. Most people don't know Donald Cerrone was 26-0-1 as a kickboxer before he went into mixed martial arts. So the opportunities are there. Shane Shaolin Campbell's another guy. Guys who went to the opportunities that were in mixed martial arts and the paychecks that were in mixed martial arts. But if we're going to grow the sport of kickboxing and Muay Thai, we've got to do our best to put on shows, to support those shows, get the athletes opportunities to compete, get the right minds and heads together, and as a group, let's get together and push the sports forward. We definitely love the game. Thanks, everybody, for listening. God bless, and I hope you all have a good one. And one more time, thank you, Caitlin Young, for being a guest.